Hello.
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 Well, hey, everybody. This is Dave Krueger. Welcome. I'm excited about our seminars on wellness that we're launching. You have probably already seen the link sent to you, a download of the outline and of the workbook, as well as the four ports for the recordings of what will be posted. Let me ask you if you would manage the background noise. If you're not ready to talk or ask a question, do mute star six, because we have a large number of people on the call. And remember, when you are ready to say something, unmute star six again. So I want to have a brief discussion with an open mic at the beginning and the end for any questions or comments that you have. And I appreciate you managing the background noise. You probably saw the couple of questions that I sent around. If we were to sit down face-to-face, what's the most important aspect of this topic that you would like to learn or have us focus on? And then after these seminars, what's the most important thing that you would like to walk away with? And I'm going to ask you in a brief discussion that I'll reserve at the end of each seminar, if you would share in just a succinct sentence what your greatest takeaway is. Once you put some, even if we don't have time for everyone's, I think it'll be important for you to consider to write it down. What we know from neuroscience is that when you put something in an output channel, it makes it more memorable and more integrated as part of your story. And to do that, simply to summarize or write something down, the simplest study that I've seen of this is, and some of you have heard me mention this before, University of Waterloo did a study where two matched groups of people read the same passage from a book, half read it out loud, half read it silently. They immediately took a test. The ones who read it out loud did 40% better because they immediately put it in an output channel to sort of synthesize and integrate it as theirs, and it made it more complete and a memory. So, and think about, that's what we do with our coaching clients at the end of the session, to ask them what's the most important thing you're taking away, and then based on that, what do you commit to do? So very, and the first two questions I ask you, the ones I sent around, those are the first two questions that you most likely ask your coaching clients. what would you like to focus on and what would you like to take away? So we're sort of using the coaching model in doing this to look at understanding and integrating some of the mind and brain and performance sciences to apply to wellness and wellness coaching, or at least the integration of wellness, mind, body, and spirit with whatever coaching you do with your clients. So anyone, and thank you for those of you who have already fired off a response to those questions, because I sent them late today. I just got the roster, or the first roster before it was revised even, late in the day. So anybody want to add anything? If we were to sit down face-to-face right now, what's the most important question you have about this topic? And then what would you like to walk away with? Anybody want to dare venture a brief response to either or both of those? Identify yourself with your name and then shout it out. Anybody dare? Remember, unmute *6. The most important thing you want us to focus on in this seminar series, it's helpful, and I appreciate those of you who have responded already, it's helpful for me to know what you really value and want to take away, and I'll integrate. I operate from the same outline that you guys have. I suggest you print it, and then you can write on it and whatever's important to you. I operate from that same outline, but I'll integrate responses to your questions in our discussion, and it'll help to guide me to know what you're interested in. Did someone begin to say something and I talked over you?
I did unmute. This is Liz. Is someone else there first?
Go ahead.
All right. So as you were speaking about all of that, I was making a few notes, and what I've been doing as kind of a big side to coaching is offering vision booking. And so I meet with some clients on a regular basis, and I've kind of integrated my coaching with that and learned so much over the years. And I have seen it firsthand where people become what they have set in stone, what they have chosen to actually paste on paper and look and be helped become true. And so I really appreciate the fact that you're willing to understand maybe where we're coming from as well and what we know. And I'm so excited about this class because wellness to me means happiness. And I think that's my focus. I think I'm going to learn a ton from this class, and I thank you.
Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate it. Just as an application of this, because I want to highlight an aspect of what you said about how we engage with our clients and where we began, would each of you draw a circle on a page? Take a page of paper, draw a circle. Inside that circle, put a stick figure. That stick figure is your client. As long as you remain outside the circle, you won't be able to really connect or communicate or at least establish a common ground to go together to a new place. Your challenge is to get inside the circle, an empathic resonance of understanding what the client wants, needs, how the client experiences things, so that you can join together to co-create a new and different story. So your challenge, as we just heard, is to understand your client and to understand the experience of your client, and then together to look from the client's point of view where the client wants to go once you've established that connectedness by you getting in the circle and having the common ground of collaboration, which is the framework of how we work in coaching. So thanks for that, and I hope that kind of makes sense. We can come back to that. Anyone else want to add or ask anything? Anything added to the hopper about what you'd like to get out of our time together, our collaboration?
I Hi, this is Dave. I'd like to learn how to impart wellness to others.
Okay. Can you put in a sentence what an ideal outcome of that would be if you were to achieve it in one sentence?
Helping the client find their way to a better path.
Okay. Okay. So the application for your comment is the same as we just begun to talk about, that your challenge is to get inside the circle to know what that client wants and how that client has established and views wellness, what their story is. So rather than superimposing your own story or some basic information, it's to get inside the circle and co-create with the client going someplace new together. And I think that's the essence of the collaborative framework that we do, because we're not about giving information. If information were enough, we'd all have a lot of money saved up. We'd all be thin. We'd eat mostly vegetables. And we'd work out every day. And a lot of librarians would be billionaires. But if you're waiting for your client to need information from you, they're going to replace you with Google instantly. So what we do is unique. It's to collaboratively help the client develop their story in a better way from their point of reference. So our challenge is to get inside that circle and to understand where the client is, to be able to keep that point of reference of the client's story, not superimposing our own or ghostwriting it, but helping the client develop to be a catalyst for that. Anything before we officially start? Anybody else want to add or ask anything at this point? Any other hopes, objectives?
Hi, Dr. Dave. I'm not sure if this was already discussed.
This is who?
Oh, so this is Erin. I'm calling in from Connecticut right now.
Go ahead. Great. Thanks.
Yeah. Sure. So something that I'm really looking forward to is just learning more about some practical activities or exercises that could be like incorporated intuitively, you know, using discernment throughout the session in order to really help clients move forward, move from, you know, one place of being stuck into freedom in a particular area that they're looking for pursuit of health.
Okay. What we're going to do, just to give you a kind of a précis of coming attractions, we're going to talk in this seminar about the power of story. And then we're going to apply in the next three seminars a particular systematic way of looking at helping someone understand and revise their story, and we're particularly focusing on wellness story. Because as many of you have heard me say before, if you really want to change, don't just focus on the goal, because everybody has pretty much the same goal. Winners and losers have the same goal. Focus on the system. So, and this is to everyone, we're going to be developing in the next three seminars a systematic way of applying the mind and brain sciences to strategic coaching to help someone understand and revise their story or create a new one. And that story, as you'll see, it could be wellness, it could be money, it could be career, life story, relationship story, the same principles. It's a systematic approach, a macro system. And I call it the roadmap, because it is the acronym for the seven steps of really understanding. So it's more of a way, rather than sending off a client to do some exercises, it's something that we can co-create with a client. And you'll see the application as we do that. So it's an overview of a way to use information and use understanding to inform your active coaching with a client. We'll return to this and can talk more about it. So I'm going to put us on lecture mode, and then we'll come back, and I'll reserve just a bit of time at the end for any clarification or questions. Okay, so our sessions will first talk about the power of story and the concept of writing a new wellness story. Now, this is going to parallel the introduction and the preface in your workbook. And then the following three sessions, as I mentioned, we're going to apply a model of coaching that can be used for individuals and groups. Now, throughout, I'm going to be speaking to you about your wellness story. The premise here is that as we really fully understand our own story in the very best way possible, that's going to be the optimum readiness and preparation for working with clients and being a catalyst for their stories. I'd encourage you to do the exercises and work pages in the workbook to parallel our discussions, and you'll see the pairing of the four seminars. Although we'll discuss application to wellness, as I mentioned, you'll see that the principles are fundamental to all growth, change, and success. Why you, may ask? Well, you're professionals who know how to listen and guide people. You are change experts and choice architects. You know that intentions need a strategy and plan. We're going to go over a proven system of transformation for lasting lifestyle change. The roadmap, as I mentioned, is the acronym for the 7 steps to create a new wellness story. It's kind of a master plan to guide you to an empowered wellness in your life story, including the tools and exercises, and then how to coach it. So first, let's look at an overview. What's the need for wellness coaching? Here's my belief. Besides the belief about information is not what you need. People don't need more advice about vitamins or told again to exercise or lose weight or stop smoking. They often don't do what they're told even when they're paid and when they pay good money to be told. For example, here's a prototype illustration. Consider going to an expert, and what happens when you go to an expert? Of people who go to a physician, and let's say the expert advice is measured by, in my example, a prescription. So you go to the expert, you're motivated by pain, by concern, maybe being afraid. You go to the expert does an assessment, as they've trained many years to do, gives you a recommendation in the form, let's say, of a prescription. How does that work? Well, slightly less than 50% of patients actually fill that prescription. Of those who fill it, slightly less than 50% take it as directed. So even when someone consults an elite expert trained years and years, and they're motivated by being scared and maybe in pain, less than 1 in 4 follow that expert advice. What do we do differently in coaching? We don't use a consultative model. We use a collaborative model. The collaboration is how you and the client get back together or get together inside that circle. I had no idea that question was going to lead to this repetition, but our framework is one of collaboration with the client's story as point of reference. And we're going to return to that and how to collaborate about looking at, understanding, and even revising and transforming that story. So back to the overview. The mission of wellness coaching is to help people establish healthier lifestyles, to write their wellness stories. Now, in addition to individuals who are interested in health and longevity, think about this. I want to put a sidebar here just of your practice and marketing for a moment. Who else needs wellness coaching? Well, one answer is any business interested in achieving some goals related to wellness, to reduce medical claims, to lower stress, to reduce absenteeism, to improve morale, to improve retention rates, and to generate overall savings to the organization. What more could you ask for in a way? So what's the scope of wellness coaching? Well, in addition to individual and group coaching, here are some of the portals of entry, the gatekeepers for wellness coaching. Human resource heads and groups, employee assistance programs, healthcare insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, small business owners, especially companies that are self-insured, school systems and agencies, natural affiliates may include fitness trainers and clubs, nutritionists, holistic care providers, healthcare providers, consortiums of wellness practitioners. Think about these various groups. More than likely, none of these groups have a professional coach who focuses on wellness in their groups. So let's move now to some practical application. Why is it that change is so difficult? In studies of coronary bypass patients, people who have just had a massive heart attack, when their lives are at risk unless they adopt healthier lifestyles, how many do you think change their habits when they have education and support to do so? 1 in 9. It took Ignaz Semmelweis more than 20 years to persuade doctors that just washing their hands could save the lives of mothers giving birth. He had the data. He had the proof for those 2 decades. But that wasn't enough to change the minds even of physicians who are trained to think scientifically. He died before people believed in change. So we know, you know from coaching, changing behavior is difficult. So what keeps people from doing what they need to do for themselves? What makes it difficult to change even when someone's life depends on it? Some of the resistance is staying in a comfort zone of the predictable and the familiar. Another component of resistance is that our brains resist change. Our brains are programmed to operate on the default mode of repetition. So keep this question in mind. Why is change so difficult? We're going to return to it and strategize about it. You have to own your wellness story. The light on the dashboard appears and says service engine now. If you disconnect the notification, it creates maybe an artificial sense of satisfaction that nothing's needed, at least not a reminder. But another term is denial. Once you know something, you can never not know it again. You have to dedicate energy at times to keep it from being in your conscious mind. Denial is still a form of engagement, even though it's invisible above ground, consciously. People are afraid to go to the doctor. They aren't afraid of doctors. They're afraid their denial is going to be confronted. Making a physical symptom go away does the same thing. The symptom is the signal, a story in itself, a story needing, even begging, to be listened to and understood. Your body will simply find another way to bring you more information. When you listen to whispers, no one needs to shout, including your body. And just because you're not sick doesn't necessarily equate with being healthy. Wellness is a mindset. This mindset gives ownership of a story of wellness to the individual. And with this ownership comes the responsibility and privilege that each thought, feeling, experience, and behavior is created each moment. We're going to come back to that because that's a fundamental principle. Warren Buffett used the analogy of buying a car. If you get a new car every few years, the approach would be different than if from the beginning you knew you were going to choose one car and have it for the rest of your life. You'd probably do research to know the best care, probably change the oil more frequently, do everything possible for maintenance. Knowing it would be the only car for the rest of your life, you'd take meticulous care of it. Your body is the only one you'll have for the rest of your life. Your body is irreplaceable. Everything about its care and maintenance matters. It reflects the cumulative care you take of it. Everything counts. Wellness integrates mind, body, and spirit with a balanced flow of energy. If you haven't already, I'd recommend you read The Wellness System of Energy in the preface of the workbook, beginning page XII. It introduces some later discussion on the impact of change on mind and brain. From the teachings of the Tao, the source of spiritual energy is physical, rooted in the base chemistry of the body. Self-cultivation refines this energy for spiritual attainment. Enlightenment is a psychophysiological achievement, a state of mind, a state of being, rather than intellectual understanding. So in this sense, spirituality is an expression of energy. So let's look now at developing a new wellness story. We are now in a revolution in the science of wellness and of aging. We understand how our bodies work at the cellular level. We understand healthy aging. We can live healthier lives than anyone in all of biological time. It's taken quite a while because health is biologically way more complex than disease. Of 3,000 people surveyed, three activities stood out above all others as ones that prompted procrastination. Three areas that people know exactly what to do and don't do it, in other words. Working out, food, and money. More than anything else, people put off exercise, a planned healthy diet, and funding their retirement plan. What if you treated a task such as exercise with the same mindset as work? Or coach your client to do this. With work, you don't get up each day and debate about whether you will or you won't, whether you're going to find time to do it, or bargain with yourself that you'll take a couple of days off but really get with it next Tuesday, or just skip it. Work is there. You get up, you go to work, you don't debate it. You don't consider yourself virtuous if you decide to do it. It's a mindset. That same mindset can be applied to working out and can be applied to what you eat and what you save. Here's a simple example. I grew up on a farm and a ranch. Every morning before school, beginning age 8, I fed the cattle. Same every evening. It was a given. No questions asked. Morning, evening, 7 days a week, cattle had to eat. My dad helped me make it a story. It stopped being work when some of them became my cattle. But it also, when I started college, when I heard people around me grinching at an 8 o'clock class, I was grateful for the first time that I didn't have to use any of my energy on complaining about the hour and about doing things because I've been doing this for over half of my life because it was a given. It was just what you do so that you can then do other important things and use your energy for what you choose. Exercise can be the same mindset, the default story, but it needs a plan and a commitment, just like, for example, your business. That's why people need coaches. What we do in coaching is to focus on the process of change by creating a system to do it. When we approach it in a systematic way and create a map, we help someone internalize a model of something, an approach, for example, that they can use the other 7 days and 23 hours that they're not talking to us. Biologically, your body only knows two things, growth or decay. Dr. Henry Lodge, Jr., who wrote Younger Next Year and a companion book, Younger Next Year for Women, I recommend this to all of the licensed, specially certified wellness coaches I train. I just recommended it to a client who only in her second session with me, I suggested this book. She got it and incorporated it into some of her approaches about what she was doing in terms of her career. So Henry Lodge said, 70% of aging is not aging, but decay. Blood vessels go to every millimeter of your body and each bathe cells in either repair or inflammation. Exercise heals wounded blood vessels. Here's a quote from Lodge in Younger Next Year. Steady exercise is a coded message to your body and your mind. In 20 years, failure to exercise 6 days a week will seem as self-destructive as smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day. I had another sidebar here personally. I had worked out 3 to 4 times a week when I became aware of Lodge's work and research. He spent 35 years of his professional life doing wellness research at a venue that we shared. I moved to his system of 6 days a week. Best thing that's happened to me, best thing that happened to me that decade, because it enhanced energy. It gave me even more of a systematic way. I would recommend the book. Dr. Christian Werner in Hamburg summarized his institute's findings. Exercise at the molecular level has anti-aging effects. We're going to look at the process of change in an informed and a systematic way. So these are simply some illustrations as a kind of warm-up. And first, I want to provide some context and stimulus for you to actively work on the exercises and quizzes in the workbook for each of the 7 steps. I think the exercises and work tools will help crystallize some awareness and really get to the question we just heard in our discussion about are there exercises or work tools that may be helpful. That way you can see if any of these would be helpful for your clients. Now, the composite is a template, a roadmap, the acronym for the 7 steps to guide and apply your wellness story. First, let's look at the power of story. Write this question down. What is my story? Think about your story. It makes you who you are, and try to do it, as we know now from neuroscience, in 10 to 12 words or less, because we tend to and retain what's clear, brief, and simple up to 10 to 12 words at a time. Summarize your plot in 1 sentence. Bullet your major storylines, not your bio, not your title, not your role, your plot. Then, secondly, write this question. What is my wellness story? Consider making an appointment with yourself to brainstorm these 2 questions. What's my story? What's my wellness story? So here are some premises that our work together will be based on in us considering the metaphor of story. Now, for our clients, I don't think this is going to work so well because for them to use our metaphor, because to them, they're not telling you a story. They're telling you the way it is. Story is our metaphor to organize and understand and consider everything from their experiences and how it unfolds for them and how they're creating it to the story of each coaching session. And a story has 3 components. The challenge, the development, the resolution. Every coaching session has that as a story, and that's the simple coaching model. So here are some premises. One, plot is the structure, purpose, and pattern of a story. For a life story, it's the life narratives. The core assumptions of life stories inform what people look for and then how they attribute meaning to those experiences. Two, we learn through stories. Our brains are hardwired for stories. It's how we understand and how we remember. James Watson, the guy who discovered DNA with Crick, said, "You know, I can remember something when I fit it into a story." A story is a system for holding together facts. A story makes things make sense. We're looking at systems in coaching. A story is that, the story of each coaching system, coaching session. Defense lawyers know this. Little kids standing next to broken vases know this. You got to have a story. Miro Rukeyser said, "The world is made up of stories, not atoms." We personify the economy or the stock market as if each were a story of its own. Well, the market handed back some of its gains today. The economy kind of took it on the chin when it was developed. Or we make a story out of events and then attribute a mind of its own. My ulcer acted up. My weight gets in the way. Three, we each have a personal story with a plot and storylines. Our beliefs and assumptions ghostwrite that story. From an infinite sea of possibilities, our software determines what we perceive and process. Our brains need a story and will infer one, so it's helpful for us to know the lexicon. Our plot consists of our core beliefs and assumptions that transform all available information into a system that makes sense. We then create life narratives according to that plot, since our minds and brains are programmed by default mode to perceive and process, and that includes ignoring things that don't fit into our assumptions, our radar of beliefs. Four, a life story contains silent assumptions and emotional scripts. Our assumption, and this is all based on the awareness now, and we know this from neuroscience, that 90 to 95% of our operating system is not conscious. So that means that there are beliefs, assumptions, blind spots, various aspects that we'll be seeing as coaches that our client will not see in the same way. So this is part of the collaborative framework of looking together at what's important in revising storylines as a way of change and transformation. Our assumptions tell us what to look for, how to perceive and process experiences. We also have to believe in order to see. Some of our beliefs and patterns may be invisible even to ourselves. Here's an example of that. Gregory Maguire, a best-selling novelist and playwright, most recently in the long-running Broadway play Wicked, recognized this. He said, "I didn't even realize this at first, but there's almost no central character in any of my 24 books who doesn't have a dead mother or a lost parent." Maguire's mother died from complications during his birth. It was after writing his 23rd book that he became conscious of this to say, "You know, I recognize this now, but I can't seem to start a novel unless the character doesn't have a mother. If the mother's still alive, the mother's still there, what's the problem? There's nothing to write about." Five, we believe and remember what fits into our plot. What we expect to happen in the present reveals instantly our experience in the past. Psychoanalysts call this transference. And we know from coaches and we know from neuroscience, this is simply using software, some of which may be outdated, but software that's already been devised to deal with various situations. Someone abandoned early in life will expect more of the same in future relationships, even though circumstances change. All subsequent information is absorbed, filtered, and organized by that narrative plot. 6. We don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. We see what we believe, and we're always right because we write the story. Here's an illustration. This is out of Oxford a number of years ago. Two anthropologists were chosen to live in separate but essentially identical ape colonies for a year to live and observe. And they were chosen because they had remarkable similarities of personality, philosophy, training, education. The two anthropologists lived in each of their respective colonies, not communicating with each other, and then emerged after a year to compare results. While they expected remarkable similarities, they had particular discrepancies that they or their research teams did not understand. One anthropologist never got beyond the social periphery of his colony. He remained careful and vigilant, always seemed right on the cusp of a conflict, never reached a harmony. The other anthropologist achieved remarkable connection and unity with his colony, got remarkable data, and was immensely comfortable in his colony. And the anthropologists and their teams could not understand these results or find any reason. They puzzled for months until they finally found one difference. The anthropologist who was the uncomfortable, careful outsider had a gun. Now, his gun never showed. He never used it. The apes never knew he had it, but he knew he had it. He knew if things got tough, he had an out. The anthropologist who had no gun instead had a commitment. He knew from the beginning that he would either make it or not on his own. And in retrospect and reconstruction, each of their assumptions created the reality that they experienced. We tell our story, then our story tells us. 7. A story can define possibility. Now, you guys know this story. In centuries of recorded time, no one ran the mile in under 4 minutes. It was impossible. It was declared by a team of scientists, including medical doctors, that if anyone ran under a mile, that it would result in their death. Dr. Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile in 1954. Within the following 18 months, a dozen other runners broke the 4-minute mile as well. The obstacle of the impossible could no longer be constructed. And now it's not uncommon for high school athletes to break the 4-minute mile. It's commonplace. When the mindset of what's possible changes, reality then changes as well. In fact, when Bannister crossed the finish line, he actually collapsed in exhaustion and was revived by smelling salts. And his first question, since the prevailing wisdom was what it was, he said, "Am I dead?" 7. A story can, 8. A story can define reality. This is also well known. A placebo generates the effect of the accompanying story. A patient is prescribed an inert pill plus some expectation, a story. In the majority of cases, the vast majority, the story becomes a reality. By anticipating experience, someone can create it. A story generates a truth so powerful it can even reverse the actual pharmacological effect of a real medicine. The placebo is a white lie. It's a fiction that becomes a truth. A recent MIT study showed that a more expensive placebo works significantly better than a cheaper one. Same placebo, different source. Now, this isn't about being gullible or suggestible. For example, when a patient believes something will reduce pain, the body releases endorphins. Medical research suggests that up to 70% of successful non-surgical treatments that rely on psychological interaction are the result of the patient's belief that the treatment will work. And what goes unstated in this is that the physician has to believe it too to convey that. 9. A story can take over the author. Listen for this as you begin working with people with these ideas in mind. Listen to these expressions. My anger took over. My fear stopped me. A feeling that someone creates can be perceived to act on them rather than someone acknowledging that they created the experience. My doubt paralyzed me. My work eroded my free time. My weight gets in the way. Someone creates a story and then sees themselves not as the creator, but as its victim even. And this is one of the reasons that with every client I work with, I request, usually in the first session, if there's something that I want us to look at or feel that would be helpful to look at in the moment, are you okay if I interrupt you? So we can freeze frame it and look at it at the instant that it occurred. And I give them permission to interrupt me if there's something that doesn't make sense. So that can be very helpful because there are a lot of coachable moments. Any inattention blindness, any bias, anything that's an assumption that's not working, a good time to look at it is the instant that it's created. So we ascribe a story with a mind of its own to our own creations. Here's another example of the power of story. A woman who recalled an incident from her adolescence. She attended a Catholic all-girls boarding school. She said, at one party, I started a rumor that the punch was spiked and everybody got drunk. So, 10. Your life is the self-statement, the manifestation of what exists inside you. What we say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of our beliefs and personal reality. All that you say and do is about yourself. Everyone is always making self-statements. You define yourself. Other people's definitions of you are more about themselves. To make them feel better of what they do or don't want to own or what they disavow or project. 11. When you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. Neuroscience shows that pure facts are a myth. Quantum physics seconds the motion. This observation came originally from quantum physics and the process of observing quarks, so we become an active component in our interaction with each client. And 12, listen carefully to this because I think it's powerful. An authentic belief in someone activates their brain to create a state of mind that transcends usual thinking and performance. That, I believe, is the most important thing that we can do or be or give to our client is to believe in them. So for me, that's I work only with clients in whom I believe. Now, this number 12 comes from neuroscience, even though good parents have known it for centuries. So let's now return, just kind of in an overview, to the question about the difficulty of change. Why do we resist change, even changing a story that doesn't work? What keeps people from doing what they know they need to do for themselves? Why will someone repeat a behavior that doesn't work, maybe do it harder, and expect a different result? This is like if somebody doesn't understand English, you repeat it in louder English. Like, that's going to do it. Even when it leads to lower energy or debt or plateaued careers or disappointing relationships or compromised health. Nassim Taleb asks in his book, The Black Swan, what are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual. So there's a two-part answer to this question. Part of the answer to why we resist change is in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone, secure, predictable. A comfort zone can be limiting or uncomfortable, but it's familiar. It's the default model. We repeat because we know how it's going to turn out, and that can create the illusion of effectiveness. A new story, even one step in a new story, and think about this when a client experiences discomfort in doing something different or new. A new story generates uncertainty, trepidation. The easiest and fastest way to end that discomfort is to stop yourself, to go back to the familiar, the old story. People fail to change because they don't feel safe changing. Changing means leaving a home base of identity, an internal map that's synonymous with how we see ourselves. We return to our default mode. Do a brief exercise. If you can free both hands, put your palms together and interlock your fingers and clasp them tightly together. Now, keep your fingers exactly the same, but change your thumb so that the other one's on top. How does that feel? And go back to the familiar, the way you had it initially. Ah, a relief. That's why people don't change. They return to their comfort zone, to what's familiar. Now, up the ante, add significant success or significant stress, like a major transition, really out of a comfort zone. We're going to talk later about comfort zones and how to help program change. And here's the principle. There is always the pull of the old and the trepidation and discomfort of the new. Always. So a comfort zone is simply a familiar pattern of behavior. It's a gradual process, but once we continue to do something, our brain hardwires it to make it automatic. Think of a comfort zone like your home thermostat. If the temperature increases or decreases, even just a degree or two, boom, there's an adjustment to return to the set point. Our minds and brains both contribute to that. We even have a comfort zone with our weight. We return to the familiar even when we don't like it or whether it's whether it's uncomfortable or not. A comfort zone is predictable and automatic. We know the outcome. Think about how subtle a comfort zone can be in determining choices. What you eat. The difficulty of starting a new exercise program. A habit is not a definition. It's a choice that gets repeated. Now, the other part of the answer to why change is difficult is in our brains. Here's an illustration. The hypnotherapist Milton Erickson told a story from his childhood in which whenever it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so that he could create a fresh path in the snow. He intentionally created a circuitous path with zigzags and indirect turns. He noticed that each person who followed him followed the same path until the end of the day the path was well worn, despite its really circuitous route. Not a single person started a new more direct route. And in subsequent days, no matter how many turns and twists, increasingly so, not a single person started a new route. Each followed the path of least resistance. This is how neural pathways are laid down in the brain, by early experiences, then repeated until they're etched more deeply, even if they don't work as well. Even if they're circuitous, discomfort and uncertainty begin any significant journey. Our brains even have an error detection mechanism located really close to the emotional center. When we try something new, registers as, this isn't normal. This isn't what I expected. We'll talk about how to use this mechanism as part of a powerful internal navigation system. So, listen for the power of story. Your brain can rewire. New experiences practiced consistently form new neuronal pathways and new neural networks. And some remarkable new research shows both beliefs as well as repeating new experiences can both alter gene expression. So when we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Metaphors and narratives also become brain structures. Also from the Black Swan, ideas come and go, stories stay. So let's look at what we do each day with our clients and with each client as we engage in a coaching narrative, choice architecture. I'm going to describe a study and have you guess the biggest change impact. Ben Fletcher at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK devised a study to get people to break their usual habits. Each day, the subjects chose a different option from poles of contrasting behavior. Lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive, proactive, talk about sports, talk about business. They would choose one of the two and behave according to their choice for the entire day. So an introverted person, for example, when they chose to act like an extrovert, would do so for that whole day. Then, twice weekly, he had them and his team had them each stretch to behave in a way outside their usual pattern, to eat something twice a week they would have never eaten before, and read something twice a week they would never have read before. So what do you think was the biggest change in this group after 4 months? The remarkable findings baffled them to start with. Was that after 4 months, the subjects lost an average of 11 pounds. 6 months later, almost everyone had kept the weight off. Many continued to lose weight. And this wasn't a diet, which was what was initially puzzling for them, but a study focusing on change and its impact. Here's the rationale. When people became aware that they engaged themselves in choices, they changed their routine, but they came to see that everything they did was a choice. What they thought, felt, experienced, that every bite of food they ate, for example, was a choice. So they began to ask, is this bite in my best interest? Instead of the usual way of taking two or three bites, kind of zoning out and eating what's on your plate. This is choice architecture in practice. This is story busting. The participants exercised choice and made it a conscious decision. This is what we do as coaches, as choice architects, to help a client be aware of a choice right now, in this moment, that it's not there until our client chooses it. So once becoming aware of activity, of actively making choices, you can decide what's in your best interest, what furthers your story, and what doesn't. So in summary, in brief overview, because I want to reserve just a bit of time for discussion, here are some principles that focus on facilitating change. This is a preface to writing a new wellness story. One, each person's life story is created. Everything in adulthood that you think, feel, and experience, each moment you create. Every day is a blank page. Two, knowing what not to do is at least as important as knowing what to do. To say that slightly different, you may not always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. Three, when people create their own answers, they have signed on to invest in the outcome. That's why, for example, you probably ask a client at the beginning of a session, what would you like us to focus on? And then, where would you like to get to? They've taken ownership of the beginning and the end of the story, and you collaboratively co-create the jazz in the middle to get there. Four, change is constant and inevitable. Usually, it's the resistance to change that generates most problems. Five, small changes lead to big changes. For example, you feel overwhelmed with the amount of tasks. Pick one thing. And then, after that, pick the next thing. Six, problems, causes, and solutions are not always related or even interconnected. And we'll come back to that because I think that's important because that's why there are a lot of frustrated therapy refugees to come to the end of an old story is not the same as creating a new one. You don't have a map or a script for the new one, kind of like COVID. 7, the benefit of doing more of what's working and less of what isn't will become evident and self-perpetuate. This is a tenet of coaching. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't, do something else. 8, you need to know where you're going, goals and strategies. If you don't know where you're going, any map will do. So the end should be in mind in the beginning. Lewis Carroll said it really well. Alice came to a fork in the road. Which road do I take, she asked. Where do you want to go? Responded the Cheshire Cat. I don't know, Alice answered. Then said the cat, it doesn't matter. 9, you need the correct paradigm. I want us to come back to that because how we frame something determines the mindset that we boot up to process it. A simple example, our brains can't tell the difference between anxiety and excitement. If you frame it as anxiety, it may make sense to stop. If you frame it as challenge, as opportunity, then you engage in a different way collaboratively to move forward, and it creates activity in the brain along new networks and pathways. And 10, decide what you want, believe it's possible. A belief is a filter between reality and our perception. A belief is a mind's command, is the mind's command to the brain, the software that drives behavior. We now know that beliefs can actually turn genes on and off. You can change your life by changing your beliefs. And our possibilities are determined by the ones we allow ourselves to see. So we're listening for, among other things, in that 90 to 95% of the operating system that's not conscious, what are the beliefs, what are the assumptions that a client has, and are they working? We're now in discussion mode. I plan to have more time, but if you don't mind to extend just a minute or two beyond our time, are there any questions or clarifications? I hope you, and next time I promise I'll manage the time a little bit better to ask you what your sentence of takeaway is, but anybody want to offer that or offer any questions or clarification before we wrap up today?
I actually just had a quick question. You had mentioned about a habit is a choice repeated. And then after that, you said discomfort and uncertainty begin any, and I wasn't sure if it was any change or if there was a different word that you used.
Anytime, the practical application is here is that anytime we do or our client does something new and different, it's going to register as a bit of discomfort, a bit of trepidation. So what's important is for us to understand that and help the client understand and interpret it correctly, that it doesn't mean that they're doing it wrong or the discomfort means their intuition is not working, but simply that this is a natural experience of doing something new and different, and it can be reframed as validation that you're doing the right thing as a way to proceed.
Sure.
So the framing here is important.
Sorry, do you remember what that specific word was that you used? Because I liked that. It was like discomfort and uncertainty begin any, was it like a shift or?
Any journey, I think, because we're talking in terms of story. So anytime we do anything that's new or different, even a small change, any step in a journey, it's going to begin. It's going to be experienced as discomfort. And it's important for us and the client to read that accurately, because otherwise they may say, well, my gut's telling me that this is not the right, it doesn't feel right, this is not the right thing. And so it's important, especially with a new experience, to have a framework and a model that can incorporate and accurately interpret and synthesize that into an ongoing story. Think about how much I mentioned COVID and kind of dropped it. Think about how much of the experience of our last 3 years has been because we didn't have a model. It was an unprecedented and unscripted time, and that was part of the difficulty. There was nothing to fall back on or to rely on in some ways. So if there are follow-up questions or comments, or especially answers to those two questions I sent around, fire them off in an email, and I will look at them and incorporate them into our discussion. Thank you for, and I want to respect our time, thank you for your participation and energy. I really look forward to continuing collaboration with you. Same time next week. You guys take good care of yourselves. See you now.
Thank you.
See you guys.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Goodbye.
Thank you for that.